Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Keela Linroth Pace from here in Austin. Keela, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Why don't we launch into, just tell us a little bit about who you are, including the explanation of your name, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, sure. On the personal side, everyone asks about my name. It is a Hawaiian name, Keela, and the general meaning is fragrant blossom, or specifically the gardenia blossom. And then when people hear that story, they often have the mistaken impression that I'm from Hawaii. I was born in Hawaii. Not true, but I do have a family connection. My mother was a child when our family immigrated from the Caribbean, actually the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago, to Hawaii. So she grew up there, but then met my father, who was stationed in the Air Force. I mean, he was in the Air Force stationed in Hawaii. He brought her back to Texas. So I was actually born and raised in Austin. I'm a unicorn. I know a lot of people think it's rare to encounter one of us. I have lived elsewhere, but I seem to always come back to Austin. I think it's a great place to be. I guess work-wise, I am a recovering, not only criminal defense attorney, but I was narrowly niched on domestic assault defense and boutique law firm owner. I had a fairly extensive solo practice and career. And then in 2015, actually started making the transition to building a team, developing a firm. And that was actually the beginning of the business coaching that led to personal development and ultimately a deep dive into mindset mastery. And that was all because of my business development journey.
You've made clear, just we didn't do this at the outset, but you are a lawyer and you've had an extensive amount of experience practicing. Taking it back sort of to the beginning, what is it that led you to the law to begin with?
Really, I was influenced by a couple of mentors, my late father-in-law, as well as aunt. Actually, this is my then husband's family, full of lawyers. Unlike me, I like to say that he was raised by a wild pack of lawyers. And I knew I was interested in going on after undergrad. I have a business degree from UT and wasn't sure, should I be looking at getting a master's degree in business, you know, maybe become a CPA. I had considered medicine actually briefly, but I'm kind of queasy when it comes to blood and stuff. So that was like, I don't know so much. And then law was really interesting, partly because it's ever changing. I had had the experience of having a great college job that got just too boring once I figured it all out and kind of cleaned up and straightened up the things that needed that kind of effort. So basically my background, my experiences, as well as the influences, and it wasn't just those two individuals, but that was really my first access to kind of close up somebody who was had spent their career practicing law. And in one case, a family law judge in Houston, the other a small town practitioner who did a lot of stuff, but primarily, you know, like civil work. So that really was it. And it, to me, the idea that I could really kind of go in and do so many things with a law degree, you know, was also pretty appealing. I honestly didn't expect to practice criminal law. I thought that I was going to be doing a commercial litigation. I mean, I was raised on Allie McBeal and I was all about the pretty clothes and the pretty offices. That seemed sexy to me, right? And then I ended up going the circuitous path, partly to get trial experience, partly because I still didn't quite know what I wanted to do when I graduated from law school. And so I ended up, because I took a bunch of crim law in law school, because I found it interesting. That's the only reason I took the classes. I did end up accepting a job. Ultimately, at first did a little bit of defense work. So I was working with my father-in-law. He didn't really quite have enough work to keep me busy. And so one of his buddies, by this point, I was living in Houston, kind of commuting up to Livingston, which is Polk County, East Texas. And father-in-law's buddy, who was the county court law judge, the single county court at law, found out that I had done the criminal defense clinic in law school. So he was like, oh, you want to take some appointed work? And I'm like, no, that's not, criminal law is not what I'm going to do. But fast forward a bit, and I was kind of getting bored. Like I said, my father-in-law didn't quite have enough work for me. And I said, you know, I think maybe I would like to take on some of those cases. So a year of doing that alongside the work with my father-in-law, I get to know the people at the DA's office. They get to know me. And I think maybe they kind of thought they would be happier having me work for them than against them.
You were doing something right.
Yeah. The person who ultimately became my boss at the DA's office first tried to hire me as a juvenile prosecutor. And I'm like, I am not prosecuting children. Ugh, no, no way. And then later, as I had kind of more time to think about what I did and didn't want to do, I did. A different job came open. It was actually a misdemeanor prosecutor, which is very different in a small town, or at least that town, than it is in a bigger city, because I got to do, I mean, I did not only trial court work, but I did appeals. I did handle protective orders, represented CPS when they came into court on a termination. And so I guess now in hindsight, I say it sort of foreshadowed the work I ultimately niched myself on doing defense work. A lot of what I was doing was actually domestic violence, prosecution, investigation, and whatnot, right? Including, it was important that it was not just the criminal cases, but also the protective orders and also the appeals and so forth. And some of the same things that drove me crazy about prosecution of DV cases later on turned out to be great for defense.
What brought you to Austin then? You mentioned this being in Houston and then Livingston.
Well, we left Austin in the first place, my then husband and I, because the dot-com crash. I had just graduated from law school. I hadn't sat for the bar exam yet. I did not have a job lined up, and I wasn't completely sure what I wanted to do, but he was in software and he mostly did contract work at that point. And when his last contract ended, so this would have been like late 2000 and going into 2001, I graduated in 2000, and the contract that he had at that time ended. And, you know, the usual process was he just picks up the phone and calls his headhunter for the next job, the next contract. And his headhunter said, we don't have anything in Austin. It's crickets here. But we've got lots of work in Dallas still and Houston. And since he had a lot of family and had come from that area, you know, that was our choice. Like, we didn't know what was going on yet. Nobody was talking about the dot-com crash, but this was really unusual and it's kind of scary, right? Like, what is this? What's going on? We weren't sure, but we really didn't have a lot of extra resources to hang on and see. So we jetted to Houston. That's where I sat for the bar exam. That's where I started my career. And fast forward my time first trying to figure it out. And I actually had a brief stint with Jones McClure Publishing before I took the job at the DA's office. And that was kind of interesting. So I was working on research and writing for the federal rules book that they publish. And the whole period basically of that work plus the defense work and doing some work with my father-in-law, adding all that together, it was probably a 3 or 4 year period. And by the time we got through that, and then I ended up leaving the DA's office, the next time we both were not completely sure we were happy about our employment situation, rather than looking for another job in that area, we had continued to, of course, keep up with friends and people that we knew in the Austin area. And it seemed like the economy had recovered, right? So rather than committing ourselves to new jobs in that area, we were like, well, hey, maybe we should try going back to Austin. And we still had family in the area. So we basically just decided to uproot and come back. We stayed with my then husband's sister. So my sister-in-law, also a lawyer, for I think it was a couple, 3, maybe 4 weeks. And he got the first job. That was the thing that, okay, once one of us gets a job, we'll move. And then once we're there, the person who doesn't have a job yet will start looking for a place to live. And so it was just sort of this little inchworm thing. That was 2005. At the time, I had left the DA's office. I was actually doing commercial litigation, gotten a job doing commercial insurance defense first. That ended up being key in my criminal law career, believe it or not, when it comes to written discovery practice. And then from that firm in Houston, I ended up coming, when we came back to Austin, the next job I had was a straight up, you know, small commercial litigation firm here. So that was a couple of years, and that's it. I learned about, from the commercial insurance defense firm, I learned a couple of things. One is I really didn't like the insurance companies and working for them and being told, no, you cannot go do another site visit because you already did a site visit. And I'm like, but I know new things now.
I know what to look for. Yeah,
exactly. I didn't know these things when I went and did a site visit before. But importantly, like I said, written discovery, that was important for later.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. It's funny how your previous experiences, even though they don't seem on the surface that they would be relevant to something, to a completely different practice area, really sometimes are. That's interesting to hear about the discovery aspect of your commercial litigation experience playing into the criminal law.
Well, first of all, the biggest reason I did not like commercial litigation is I was spoiled by being in the courtroom all the time. As a prosecutor, I was in court every day. And it was fun. That was the most fun job I've had as a lawyer. But yeah, the written discovery process in commercial insurance defense wasn't necessarily fun, but it was very methodical. It was very systematized. And it really taught me how to enforce the discovery laws that came later in criminal defense. All right. So in 2014, we had the Morton Act go into effect, which changed the landscape for criminal discovery. But it provided zero guidance in how to use it, how to enforce it, how to even make a request under it, right? Like for discovery. So that's why later on down the road, when I started getting feeling, okay, I'm going to start using this, as far as I could tell, my colleagues weren't really using it yet. This is like probably 3 months into it going into effect. And so I'm like, all right, so how do I actually do this? And started making requests orally, because that's the way they just did it in these courts. This is in Austin. I'm back in Austin by this point. And then coming to court the next month, like, so I make an oral request, or they also, some of the courts started saying, how about you send it to us via email? And so I'm in court on this day. And then fast forward a month later, when I'm back in court at the next court appearance, and they're telling me I never made that request, or they're saying, we never got that request, or they're saying, well, you made the request, but you didn't say that, the ambiguity and whatnot. And so
that sounds very familiar to us civil lawyers out there.
Yeah, I bet. Well, and that's the thing, you know, I was like, you know what? I know exactly how to deal with this. I propound a written discovery request, fax it to your office, fill in a certificate of service, and then file it with the court to prove exactly what and when I requested. And what was really cool about it for me is that the county attorney's office and the district attorney's office, they had no idea. They like right hand, left hand stuff going on where I was faxing it. I was getting my fax confirmation sheet. I was filing all this with the court, but they could barely find their own damn faxes. And so I was like doing all this, and I was making a record, and I was making absolutely clear what I had requested and when, going into court, telling them, nope. And here's what so fast forward now, say 8 months or more, you know, I have a prosecutor telling me and trying to tell the judge that I never requested that. And of course, now what do I do? Like, how about you go ahead and get out your file and let's get the court's file out and see what I actually requested and when, right? All kinds of things like that. So many war stories. And it was some really awesome things, but also some really exhausting things, especially when I started winning some of these battles, having discovery hearings. At first, my primary judge did not, the DV court did not actually want to give me a hearing, even though it said in black and white letter of the law that I was entitled to a hearing. So we had this backlog of cases that weren't getting a hearing. The prosecuting agencies were not producing the things that I'd requested. But when I finally start winning and they actually start producing the things, and then some of the prosecutors are smart enough to start producing it regardless of what's happening in the rest of their agency, right? But as I start actually winning and getting all the things I want, now what has to happen? Now I got to review it.
Oh, yeah. Be careful what you wish for.
Exactly. And now I'm starting to get overwhelmed. I'm still battling, you know, the agencies. I call this period of time, it was probably a 2-year, 3-year period, the discovery wars.
Eras of your career, the discovery war period. Yeah.
Absolutely. The discovery wars. And that's part of what led me to be so overwhelmed that I actually needed to seek out business coaching to learn how to do things like hire and delegate and create systems that allow me to do that responsibly. Allow me to continue getting the good results that I was getting, even if I wasn't the one actually doing the work, all of the work myself, learning how to supervise and direct a team, build a team, So yeah, that written discovery practice was hugely pivotal. I mean, there were so many cases that got dismissed like on the trial docket just because of all that work that I had done.
The discovery wars period, from there you transitioned into?
This 2014 really to 2017 was the discovery wars.
Okay. And then after that, you focused on domestic assault defense and applied what you learned?
So my focus on domestic assault defense happened fairly naturally and almost organically from the beginning of hanging my own shingle, right? So when I went back to criminal law, and at first I was practicing with a friend from law school just for a few months while we both kind of figured out he was moving back to Austin from California. And actually, I had gotten laid off by the firm that I was working for doing commercial litigation at the end of a 3-month unpaid maternity leave. And that was pretty harsh, pretty brutal. And I had this sense like, I don't think I want to go back to these small firms. I mean, prior to these two jobs, it was back-to-back pretty bad experiences for different reasons. My impression was small firm life was the way to go, that that was going to be more family friendly, that that was going to have more reasonable expectations and whatnot than the big firms and the horror stories I'd heard from friends and family there. But my experience was not good with them. And especially in the context of interviewing, being able to really identify the firms that have a good culture versus the ones that are really going to tell you what they know you want to hear and you take the job. And so that was getting laid off at that firm was probably a good thing, but at the time it didn't feel like it. But it's definitely what led to very directly to me starting my own law practice. It was probably month 4 after my son was born, my first child, that my friend and I started taking some cases together. And then within 3 or 4 months, we figured out our practice styles weren't really that compatible. I was going much more like low volume, high quality. He was going more high volume and not necessarily wanting to put as much time and effort into each individual case. So that was what caused me. This was like late 2006, early 2007 is really when I hung my own shingle. And from the beginning, I said, I'm only doing criminal law. That, I guess, sort of informal partner, law partner and I had made the mistake. I don't know if it was a mistake of taking a custody case in Travis County. And I got a sense for what family law in Travis County is like. And I was like, oh gosh, no, I am never doing this again. And I got a good result for my client, thankfully, but I was like, nope, nope, nope. This is just life's too short to deal with these JAs. I was like, I'll stick to criminal law. Thank you very much. And so I did that and started asking myself the question and took to my ex's credit. You know, he was part of these conversations like, well, what kind of cases do I enjoy handling? What kind of people do I want to work with? And that was part of what was informing what we put on my website, right? So Q&As, for example, when people are searching for an attorney, what are they looking for? What are they typing into the box? And of course, both of us had a software background. I don't know if I mentioned this. My business degree was in management information systems. So I had IT, I knew how to make a website. It was actually a hobby pre-law and whatnot, which has come in handy. My then husband, yeah, we were married by that point, but he was a software developer and did also a lot of web-based stuff. So for us, it was a natural thing to be asking ourselves these questions and kind of thinking in terms of organic marketing. And as I asked myself those questions, I realized it had to be either DWI or domestic assault because it's the normal people crime, both of them. Who do I like working with? Well, people who actually care about their cases as much as I do. It's a problem. And I had had enough experience at this point to doing court-appointed work that many of my clients did not care about their cases as much as I did not care about the results as much. And that was a problem. So DWI and assault family violence. And then I ultimately got to a place with DWI where I was like, you know what? I'm going to take the class. Lance Platt, a former DPS trainer who actually went and pursued a master's degree, you know, all this data. And he was teaching defense attorneys basically certifying them to administer the field sobriety tests, right? Which is obviously hugely valuable if you're doing DWI defense in court, you know, trial court level. So I was like saving, I think it was $750 at the time, which, you know, was a lot of money to me at that point. And I was like, okay, I'm going to take that class because I really want to nail this. And I took the class. And what I realized and concluded from the class is it's all a bunch of junk. It's junk science. And yet it's accepted by the courts, right? Like, I don't have the time, energy, or money to fight this battle. right? So I either have to buy into it to some extent and play the game if I really want to get great at this type of work, or I just need to say, no, it's not for me. So that was kind of a hard decision. But by this point, I was probably already at about 85% assaultive offenses on my docket because of the way that my then husband and I had been creating content, I guess, for my website. So it ended up not being that hard of a decision to finally just say no. And part of that was led by when I did start doing business coaching, the coaches that I was working with encouraged me. They're like, you're already on the right track, basically with niching yourself.
Niching down. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you might want to consider doing it, just going all the way. So within the first 6 months, I'd say, doing business coaching, I made the decision to just stop accepting other types of work, unless it was a companion case or there was some reason for us to be involved in it. If you're calling our office with just a DWI, I'm going to send you to another good attorney who handles that type of case. Ideally, primarily that type of case. I really like referring stuff to specialists.
Well, so you developed your niche practice and carried on as a solo for quite some time, as I recall. But then at some point, you made an affirmative decision to transition. You loved coaching so much, you decided to become a coach. Is that fair to say?
It's not exactly how it worked, but yes. I mean, in essence, that's what happened. But really, it was when I got to a certain place in my own business and personal development journey, I started understanding some things. Some things became clear to me. And the most important one that led to me coaching was, by this point, I was basically handling, and I had a team, we were handling high-end domestic assault defense cases. So a lot of our clients were professionals, affluent people, people who were very effective in their ordinary lives. And yet they find themselves in this position. And there was another little key there that had baffled me for a long time, right? So many of our clients are, you know, are good people, they're effective people ordinarily. Why don't more of them do all of the things in this list of things we typically had for our clients to help us get the best possible result, right? So any good criminal defense attorney is going to have some standard things and then probably some case-specific things that they're going to recommend to their client to say, here are the ways you can help us. These are going to potentially maximize the result we can get in your case and or how quickly we can get there. So those were the things that it was like, why don't more people do all of the things? Because if it were me and my law license on the line, and yes, I represented attorneys, so this is a real question, doctors, nurses, I mean, all kinds of professionals, like, and my business on the line and my reputation on the line, I would do every single thing that my attorney suggested might possibly help. And instead, I'm sometimes getting pushback from clients who are going, is that really going to help? Because that sounds like not something I really want to do. You know, I can't promise you that this particular thing will, but I can tell you from vast experience. So by this point, I had a team of badass attorneys, paralegals, even an investigator on staff. And our collective experience was pretty extensive. And everything I had learned as a solo about what's really effective and what really helps was validated by these attorneys I ultimately brought onto my team as pinch hitters initially, and then kind of became part of the whole process. I'm going, why in the world would these people push back on these things? Right? I can't promise you that going to do counseling, for example, at the start of the case, and continuing on for 18 months or even potentially more than that, 2 years, 3 years, is absolutely going to make a difference in your case. But I can tell you that over time, that's one of several factors that I have seen absolutely helps our clients get the best possible results. So when I got to a certain place in my business development journey and started understanding what things had been getting in my way, that's when I suddenly had this epiphany about our clients and what was getting in their way. And it really was the same things that caused them to create this result in their lives in the first place. Because guess what? Probably half our clients weren't actually guilty. And that's one thing about domestic assault defense, I'd say more so than some of the other cases in criminal law. You see a lot of people who are not guilty. I never kept track of stats, and you don't always know for sure, honestly. But my sense of it is probably half of our clients were guilty and roughly half of our clients were not. But they all had something in common, that is that they had created circumstances in their lives that led to this result, whether it's toxic relationships or lots of different things there. And that was the thing that was like, aha, okay, they're getting in their own way. They have blind spots, and they could really use some of our clients who are ready to see this incident in their life as a wake-up call and actually make some major changes. Because there are those people who're like, you know what? I am never going to let this happen again, ever in my life. And I recognize that there are things I could have done, should have done differently, guilty or innocent, that I want to make sure this doesn't happen again. And those people were ripe for what I called at the time accountability coaching. And because I was out of the trenches myself as an attorney, I was no longer the attorney in court every day, the attorney, you know, prepping cases for trial or being down at docket call every other week. I had the time, I had the energy, I had the creativity to figure out how I could add this value add service for those select clients. And of course, you know, let's be clear, private coaching is not cheap. So they had to have the resources. They also had to be ready to do the work. It started with accountability coaching. In other words, helping them work through that list and get as much of it done as they could. But that invariably led to mindset coaching. And that I've discovered is what lights me up.
I could see how you could really be energized by that. If you had the experience of a lot of clients who gave you that pushback, if you had a select group of clients who actually maybe took the list and said, yes, I want to do these things, help me do it and hold me accountable to use your terminology of accountability coaching, that's great. But you make this transition into coaching specifically lawyers who I suppose there's some level of accountability coaching as part of what you do today. But as you point out, you've got people who are willing to come to you and then pay you for the benefit of your experience. And it's helpful, I think, to have heard sort of where you come from on this, because anybody can come on and say, I do coaching for lawyers, but it's one thing to be trained up and all that in this area. But I think there is value in talking to someone who actually has lived it and gone through it. You've said before that you sought out coaching yourself, so saw the value in it. I think it's very interesting that you actually offered that to your criminal defense clients as an add-on service. I don't know how many other lawyers have done that.
As far as I know, it's a first, but I haven't done a survey. It's something, as I learned, really the creative process is what I'm going to call a component of mindset mastery that's about creating the things that you want to do, be, and have in your life. And doing it from a much more intuitive approach than was previously the way I accomplished things in my life, right? So prior to mindset mastery studies, coaching and whatnot, and the deep dive that I did in 2017, okay, that was important because the original business coaching from 2015 to 2017 taught me much more technical things that were important about running a business, about what it takes to have a healthy small law firm. But I got stuck, and the mindset mastery, the deep dive I did there, became critical to me moving forward.
To kind of build on that a little bit, it seems like you brought this concept of mindset mastery. Well, is it a matter of making the decision to affirmatively do things that are going to improve your career in life rather than being reactive to things that are happening to you?
That's definitely a part of it, right? So being intentional about what you're doing from both a macro perspective and a micro perspective, right? So the macro perspective would be getting in touch with your big picture vision for your life, for your work, for your business, for your law practice, for your relationships, every aspect of your life, really. That big picture vision is what I'm calling the macro part of your intentionality, saying, I get to decide. So if I'm not being proactive about that decision, then I'm kind of letting things develop that may not serve me well in my life, that may not be creating things in my life that I actually want. But then it's more than just the big picture vision, right? When you hear people talk about vision boards, which are a lot of fun, but I think a lot of people misuse them. It's a good tool. It's a fun tool, but on its own, I don't know that it's particularly valuable. You have to look at the micro aspect of intentionality as well. Like, what are you doing from moment to moment, day to day, week to week, month to month, right? Because our entire life and our productivity and everything we create comes down to those moments, right? So we can have this big picture vision, but if we're not actually aligning our actions, our thoughts, our feelings, our experiences, such that it's actually kind of pulling us or drawing us the direction we want to go, then we're probably still not going to create the things that we want, no matter how pretty our vision board looks.
I was just going to say, so a lawyer that might come to you, like, what are you looking for in a client? Or I guess, what is a client that is looking for you? What do you typically see when someone comes to you?
So I don't always know exactly what it is that they see But what I can tell you is that there tends to be, it's sort of like what I am saying, what I'm doing resonates with them. And I can't really make that decision for someone else, right? It has to come down to their internal sense of whether or not I resonate with them. That's really it. And that's part of the reason I do a lot of speaking engagements, even ones that are a volunteer basis with our local bar associations and whatnot. Because basically, I think it's important in the work that I'm doing to make myself sort of a lighthouse. And that way, the people who want and need what I have to offer see me and are attracted to me and come to me. And that's kind of the way that I do it, more so than trying to chase people down. I mean, A, I don't chase. That's just not an energy I want in my life. But B, it also comes down that I am not necessarily the one who identifies, who figures out, oh, that's a person I want to talk to more. That's a person who may have something to offer me. So I find it can go along the lines of, I do a speaking engagement and then I get somebody reaching out to me via my website or LinkedIn, or usually during every speaking engagement, try to make clear to people how they can reach me. You know, here's the way to connect with me if you want to know more, if you have questions, and et cetera. And I've changed that process a little bit over time to protect my time more. I used to always do a free, for anybody who wanted it, a free 30-minute call that I called a strategy call if they had additional questions and whatnot. But I've been finding with the speaking engagements and that I'm needing to shift more to a one-to-many situation, like the speaking engagements. And what I now am doing is encouraging people, if they get on my website and are looking at if they want to work with me, then I kind of want them to do a little more homework first to see whether or not. So if you haven't attended one of my speaking engagements, for example, you know, here are some things you can do. Like I've got the UT Law CLE workshops, you know, you can go do one of those, or you can follow some of the stuff I'm doing on social media. Because what I don't want to do anymore of really is getting on the phone and spending an hour with somebody on a call when it turns out it's not a good fit. They have no idea that private coaching is a significant investment, right? Time, energy, money. And then back to your question about who am I looking for? I am looking for people who are ready to do the work, right? That they have gotten to a place to like, I want to make a change. It's really critically important to me. Typically, we're talking about law leaders. This was actually a recent epiphany because I love helping attorney moms. And that's actually the next step that was important in my transition to focusing on lawyers was my local attorney mom group. It's called Mamas Austin. Very active, wonderful group. And I've been a member since my older son, who's 17, I was probably like 2 years old. And more recently, I've stepped into leadership. So I'm on the board. But early in the pandemic, it was posts on we have a very active Facebook group about how all of the stressors for attorney moms that got exponentially worse because of the pandemic, you know, having their kids at home and recognizing when they're posting like wanting tips and help with how can I manage all this? And like everybody else, I would throw in my favorite 2 cents about some of the strategies that I find helpful. But there was one post in particular, I don't know why this one bothered me the most, where I realized this response is actually pretty superficial. And I know how to solve this problem because I solved it for myself. And I understand and recognize by this point the value, the tremendous value of what I've created for myself here in changing my job, changing my experiences, changing my life, you know, going from completely stressed out, like attorney mom guilt, anxiety, overwhelm, burnout, insomnia, you know, all the things, to actually being at peace more often than not, having peace of mind, learning how to navigate more effectively, enjoying the life I'm living now while I create the things that I want in my life. And somehow I was like, I don't know, holding something back, and I'm just throwing in these little tips. And yet this is not really, when you're just responding to Facebook group inquiry or question, whatever, there's no way to really convey the substance of this because it's a lot, right? There's a lot to it. And that was sort of the beginning. And so I ended up on the phone with one of my friends having a connection call, who she's the founder of that group. And we were chit-chatting about that. And she asked me, would you consider doing a workshop for our group? You know, just come and do a presentation, maybe like a 1 hour lunchtime thing. And that was the beginning of it, right? So for the longest time, probably 2+ years, I was focused on attorney moms. It was more recently that I realized, and it was because of a specific person who did exactly what I said before. I think it was the Capital Area Trial Lawyers Association that I had spoken to. The very next day, I get a message from my website, somebody who's the owner of a small to mid-sized law firm saying, I'd like to talk to you about potentially coming in and training, coaching my leadership team. That began a series of conversations where I was like, oh, I'd absolutely be happy to talk to you about that. That's something I could totally do. So figuring out what that would look like and whatnot. And as I'm chewing on it, I just had this epiphany at one point, like, what is it? Because this person seemed pretty ideal also, even though he's not an attorney mom. So what is it that makes him ideal? And I don't just mean that he wants to hire me. I'm talking about in the dialogues that we were having, he seemed ready. He seemed willing. And part of the thing that was refreshing over some of the women I had been talking to in the last 2-3 years was that he was so ready and willing to commit the resources to this necessary training. And the epiphany went along the lines of the reason that I was ready and willing and able to invest such an extraordinary amount of time, energy, and money into my business and personal development was not because I'm an attorney mom. It's because I owned a law firm. The stakes were very high. This is my livelihood. By this point, I actually have a team and commercial leases and all kinds of things that I'm maintaining. It's absolutely critically necessary that I figure out how to make it work. And so when I realized that part of the problem was actually my personal development, right? That was part of how I got stuck. It was a mindset thing. You can bet I'm going to make it a priority and I'm going to go down that path and whatnot. So that was the thing I realized was kind of a missing component for some of the people. As much as I would love to help them, what was missing in terms of really being able to coach them? They're not ready. They may never really be ready, willing, or able to invest those kind of resources in it. The other piece though is I created a mastermind group that is a better fit for folks who it's like, eat what you want. If you invest in private coaching, you better do it. Right?
You got a direct accountability partner.
Right. And part of the accountability, though, actually is your pocketbook. That was certainly true for me. When you make a significant investment, which if you're working with a good coach for private coaching, it's a significant investment. And you can't afford to blow it off. You can't afford to not show up and not do the work. So that was part of the key. And you know, I'm still figuring this out. Like I'm still very much in startup mode with my coaching practice. And I'm celebrating right now because it's been about 18 months, maybe a little more, since I'd made the decision to take a leap of faith and actually shut down my firm. And I now have just one criminal case left. And I'm like, it's kind of scary. Not just criminal case, legal. That's it. So it's almost completely done now. So it's all about the coaching. Part of that is it's like walking the talk. When I realized that actually continuing to run my law firm was keeping me from doing what I needed to do in really launching my coaching practice, I realized that was actually what I had to do. I had to shut it down.
You had to burn the boats.
I did. And not everybody has to do that, right? I'm jealous of the people who can just do a little side hustle and grow it. And then no, for me, that was actually holding me back.
In the legal industry, who can really do that?
Yeah, maybe you're right.
It plays to your observation. In practice, you like to refer to specialists. It's hard to imagine someone having great success doing a kind of a side hustle in the law. We all know law is hard. You got to hustle to make it and keep it up. And so it sounds like to me, Keele, that what you've done essentially is you've shifted, but you've continued to sort of niche down. And now you've decided, okay, well, instead of practicing full-time domestic assault defense, I'm going to do this other thing that I really like and help other people learn from what I learned. And so I think that's way cool. And I'm always interested. We've had other lawyers on the show before who are non-practicing now. They've moved on and do various types of consulting work. And I'm always interested because I think it's something to consider is what is life after law going to look like for lawyers? And I admire people who have decided this is the other thing I'm going to do. I'm going to build on the experience that I gained and all this time as a lawyer, because really you can get a life coach or you can get a business coach as a lawyer, but is there really anybody better suited to coach a lawyer than someone who's actually been through it?
That's probably true, but there is one thing I want to make sure we touch on here, because I think we would be doing a lot of lawyers a disservice if I leave any impression that you have to leave the law in order to completely change your experience, to change your job, to change how it feels and what you're doing. Because that's something that, like, before I did decide to go down the coaching path, my job, I had managed to improve it significantly through the work that I was doing. When I started going down the mindset mastery path and really doing a deep dive in that, I learned a different way of approaching and problem solving, approaching the creative process, creating what I want to do, be and have in my life, in other words. And that really did make a huge difference, right? Like prior to that point, success for me was always this endeavor of like pushing a boulder uphill to learn the things and do the things and figure the things out. And that was not just law. That was even before law, but especially in law. And that was the initial days of my business too, even after I started business coaching, first couple of years of it. But making that shift and making that transition actually allowed me to more like get in the flow of things where the decisions that I was making were more intuitive, were more based on what feels good and what feels right. And as hokey as that may seem to folks, you know, on the other side of this path where I was, where I started, where everything needed to be concrete, right? Where the idea of anything woo was extremely off-putting to me. At that point, I didn't really have the tools to do it the way I did it in the later part of my legal career. But when I started using these tools and really applying them to my life, applying them to my legal work, applying them to my business, I did. I mean, within like a 9-month period, and at this point, I was working with a private coach myself. And in fact, there was one, here's a tip. There was one thing, one question he taught me to ask myself that became super pivotal and enabled me to change my job over a 9-month period. And of course, this is something more for people who have their own practice than if you're working for somebody else. I think you can do similar things when you're working for somebody else, but obviously that somewhat depends on the system in which you're working, right? But since I was the boss, you know, it was my law firm, I had a team, I was in a position where I could make changes. And the question was this, anytime I started feeling like things were heavy and hard, he said, ask yourself, what would this look like if it were easy and fun? And that's it. I didn't have to know the answer right off the bat. But in terms of mindset, the fact that I was asking myself that question, it's almost like I was giving myself a task that my subconscious mind couldn't help but pick up and think about and chew on and start having little ideas here and there. And sometimes they were small things and small adjustments, and other times they were bigger things and bigger ideas that I would implement. And then start paying attention when you hear that answer, the response of like, but what if I did this or what if I did that? So literally over about a 9-month period, my job became so much better. I mean, there were still challenges, there were still difficulties, but it still was a transformation where I was now running my law firm and doing my work and enjoying it.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. And very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
How much of this really boils down to psychology? Sort of, you talk about mindset mastery, it's almost like you're tricking yourself into looking at things a certain way.
Absolutely. Some of them are hacks.
Yeah. And I hate to use that word hacks because it implies you can do something just one step, you know, two steps and you'll fix everything. Well, that's not the case. Generally,
there are coaches in the industry that you'll see their little, what it is, workshop or whatever, where they do that three simple steps to blah-de-da and implying that everything's going to be smooth sailing after you do their 4-week workshop or 6-week workshop, whatever. That's really irresponsible.
But it is true, though, that there are certain little tricks like what you just described that can really make a big difference in how you view your work, your life, et cetera. There are sort of little hacks like that that really do help, but they're not the be-all, end-all solution.
Correct. I think it's important to kind of learn how we think, how we work. And, you know, for me, that's basically like 4 building blocks to mindset mastery. This is the sort of survey workshop that I do, Mindset Mastery 101. That was that first workshop that I did for Mama's Austin, right? The local attorney mom group. And the challenge there was trying to figure out how to do a 1-hour workshop where I really actually can provide meaningful information about what it all is.
Can we run through those building blocks real quick?
Oh yeah, sure. The first one most people have heard of, and it's mindfulness. And that starts with meditation, okay, learning the basics of meditation. But where a lot of people, I think, don't make the connection here is that's only the starting point. You learn the basics of meditation, and then I feel like it's so that you can then take, and you continue practicing also, right? So doing a daily meditative practice is helpful. It can be a minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. I typically don't do more than 5 minutes. And in the very early days, if I had to be in court, we're talking 1 minute. on days I didn't have to be in court, 3 minutes. And I couldn't see doing more than 3 minutes for years, right? Relatively recently that I decided I'm going to try doing 5 minutes as my typical daily meditation. I feel like the learning the basics of meditation and practicing it, the point is actually not that practice. It's then having the tool to take into your day-to-day activities, taking meditative practice into the task that you're working on, into the conversation that you're having with a person, especially if it's a challenging person and so forth, sitting in traffic, right? And so what I mean specifically, and a lot of people overcomplicate meditation too. It's very simple. And I always know that they're doing this if they go, oh, it's just so hard because, you know, there's so much chaos and I've got so much stress going on. I don't have the time. It's so hard to do it. So I just don't prioritize it. That means they must be thinking that you have to stay present. It's hard because I can't do that. But that's not what meditation is. Meditation is the practice itself. In other words, just simply choosing to focus on something that's in the present moment, right? So that might be your breathing. That might be, in fact, some people will just do breathing and stay focused on the breathing and then come back to the breathing, right? But I prefer to kind of let my mind go from breathing to the way that my body is pressing into the seat beneath me. From there, I might go to the feel of the air on my skin, noticing whether it's still or if there's a breeze, like maybe there's a fan if I'm sitting inside, whether it's warm or cool, et cetera. Sitting there noticing what's going on in your present circumstances, whether it's your breathing or whatever else you're choosing to focus on. And then your attention wanders, right? You get distracted by a thought or a feeling. First of all, noticing that it's happened, right? A. B, reminding yourself that that's okay. That's normal. It's part of being human. And it's actually part of the practice, right? So there's no need to feel upset about it or like you're doing it wrong. It's part of the exercise. You just notice that it's happened. Let go of the thought or feeling that distracted you, and then turn your attention back to whatever it is you're choosing to focus on, right? It's that simple. And it's that practice. Like, it doesn't matter if you get distracted 10 times. That doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. The fact that you noticed that you got distracted and then turn your attention back to the present moment or whatever it is you're choosing to focus on, that's it right there. That's the practice. And the more you do that, and the better you get at it, the better you get at staying present when you choose to stay present. And here's where the magic comes in. It makes you more effective at whatever it is that you're doing. You're more present for the people that you want to be with, whether that's your family or your clients or a challenging person that you want to kind of make sure that you make the most of the time that you're with them. This might be a client or difficult opposing counsel or something, right? So that's it really right there in a nutshell. And what's cool about it is when you're staying present here, right now, as opposed to caught up in past remembrances, things that are already gone, they're not here, they're not now, they're not even fully real because of the way perception works and memory works. What's in your head about something that's gone and past isn't truly reality, right? Nor is projecting into your future worries, right? What might happen and so forth. And what's really interesting about lawyers is we actually have to do some of that as part of our jobs, right? To be effective litigators. I mean, we really actually have like issue spotting, dwelling on what went wrong and what might go wrong in the future. Well, here's the cool thing about mindfulness practice. It is one of the most powerful tools in finding and maintaining peace of mind, releasing anxiety, releasing, you know, all of these negative thoughts and feelings. It really brings us almost instantly to center and allows us to let go of all the negative feelings that are dragging us down. That's mindfulness.
To identify for us, if you would, real quick, the other three building blocks of mindset mastery.
Acceptance. This is also called surrender. And I'm not going to spend as long on it. The basic thing here is just learning to be okay with the fact that you are where you are who you are. The other people you're dealing with are who they are. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are giving up the right to change things that you can. So that's sometimes people will get confused and go, oh, but does acceptance mean that I'm going to change it? Nope. In fact, it's the first step in changing it, really understanding, recognizing where you are and being okay with that and saying, it's just where I am, rather than pushing back on it, which doesn't really help us, doesn't serve us well. So acceptance, surrender, that's another, you could do a deep dive on, that's a whole component. And there are practices. And my favorite resource on that particular one is a book called Letting Go by David Hawkins. It teaches you a really simple practice for learning to accept things and let go of thoughts and feelings that don't serve us well. So that's the second building block. Number three is, in the coaching industry, it's called personal responsibility. I like to call it self-empowerment. And it's not because I have a problem with the term personal responsibility, but I do find that a lot of people, especially it seems like in lawyer groups, think we're talking about blame when we talk about personal responsibility. And we're not talking about blame at all. We're not talking about whose fault is it that we are where we are. Rather, it's about who gets to take responsibility for changing things. And when it comes to our own lives, our own experience, really nobody else is better suited to doing it, right? To making whatever changes it is that we need to make. Most people, we are the only ones who truly can make that change. And another component of personal responsibility is learning to understand we can actually change our experience with the exact same inputs, right? So same experience, same things happening, but we get in the driver's seat of what's going on in our own mind, and we can actually change our experience. We're having a better experience with the same people, the same situations, and so forth. So that's, like I said, it's called personal responsibility, but I think of it as self-empowerment because we really are giving ourselves the power to create what we want in our lives, to recognize if there's something I don't want in my life, I'm the one who gets to make the change, and I'm really the only one who can. So that's the third building block. And then the final one, I've already talked about some, the creative process. And it was just learning the basics for how we go about making those changes once we've decided that we want to, from the more creative, intuitive perspective rather than competitive, the way that tends to drag us down and feel like we're pushing a boulder uphill.
Oh, yeah. That's super helpful to just get that big picture. And I know we could spend a lot of time talking about each one of those.
Yeah. And there are things that I didn't touch on, like gratitudes and where that fits in. And there's so many things, tools, journaling and whatnot. But I mean, just having that framework helps me, you know, kind of understand. And usually I'm fitting, some things address more than one of those building blocks, but that's how I view it. That's how I teach it.
Well, one other thing that I wanted to ask you about, I know you've also do as part of your speaking gigs, you talk about boundaries. And I think it's something I would really like for our listeners to hear you talk about for a few minutes, just because I think it's something that we don't often give ourselves permission to install or enforce. So let me just kick it over to you and let you launch into that, if that's all right.
Absolutely. And so there are a couple of things I want to say about boundaries. First of all, I think that we are actually doing a service not only for ourselves, but for others when we set appropriate and healthy boundaries. We're kind of giving them a roadmap for how we need to be treated to function well. And also to be happy to have them in our space. So when we learn to set effective boundaries, then other people can trust us more to let them know if they ask something of us and we're not okay with that. And it's something I've actually taken to telling people more often lately, now that I'm better at setting boundaries, like, you know what, you can trust me to let you know if I have a problem with that going forward in the future. And people really tend to appreciate that when you get good at it. So, you know, the idea that we're being selfish when we set boundaries, I think it's actually the opposite. You know, it can be challenging, but everybody benefits when we learn to set healthy and appropriate boundaries. And then it could be critically important. I mean, staying on the theme of law. And of course, I mean, you guys are appellate attorneys. I've done some appellate work, and I know that there are going to be, you know, areas where this comes up in appeals as well. But especially at the trial court level, that's what I can speak to more. In the early days of my practice, I didn't understand or realize that I could or should set boundaries with specifically court staff and judges when it comes to scheduling. So I was in court almost every day, and I'd have a court coordinator or a judge, you know, throwing a date at me for a contested hearing or trial or that sort of thing. And of course, if I had a hard conflict, I knew that I had to address that and get that cleaned up. But what I didn't really even have the experience or the wisdom to understand at that point is that to be the most effective lawyer, I actually needed to do a better job of setting boundaries for other things too, like having time to do my out-of-court work. If I'm in court all the time, there's a whole bunch of work that needs to be done in order to get the best possible results for my client that I can't do. Also, having a life, having time to rest and recharge and feed myself well and spend time with my children and go to the doctor and all of those things. And so it was much later in than it should have been, than I would have liked for it to have been in my career, that I realized I could and I should actually decide. When I was a sole practitioner, much less the owner of my own law firm, I'm absolutely empowered to sit down with my calendar and say, how am I going to function best? How am I going to thrive? How can I map out the best use of my time during the week, on the weekends and the evenings? You know, and of course, evenings and weekends became something that I was protecting for my family, for myself, you know, for personal purposes, a day for business development, right? Business and personal development things. That became my Mondays. Time for doing that out of court work, for returning phone calls, for having client appointments and whatnot. So this became critically important. And I actually do a workshop on setting boundaries, and that can be a process in itself because it's ongoing, right? So learning how to, A, identify that you need a boundary in the first place, then B, going, okay, so what does that boundary look like? What should I set my boundary around, right? And then, you know, the process of actually doing it, because that can be sort of a trial and error thing. When I first started setting boundaries with court staff and judges, for example, I didn't realize that there were certain words and certain language. They're almost like magic words that would make this easier. For example, vacation. I was trying fancy things about like, oh, well, I'm doing the better. Well, this time is I'm not available because this, that, and the other. And I'd get pushback from a judge or court coordinator, and I'd be kind of frustrated. And then I realized that they understand the word vacation, you know? So some of the things that I was trying to describe differently slotted pretty easily into vacation. And once I started using that magic word, they didn't give me any trouble on it. Those kinds of things where you just have to kind of make some adjustments. Or it might be, for example, since I did domestic assault defense, I spent a lot of time in court four, which is in Travis County. That's our domestic assault court. And there's no way that I could take Friday as my primary day for doing business and personal development, because that's when we had the biggest docket when it comes to court appearances, when it comes to contested protective order hearings and things like that. And there's just, unless I wanted to change my practice area, Friday was a necessary day for me to block off for court, right? Those kinds of things.
Those are all really interesting thoughts about boundary setting, especially setting boundaries with courts. I'm thinking as we're talking about, now that I'm away from solo practice and I've been back in a law firm for a few years, you know, we have young lawyers here in the office, try to spend some time mentoring. And also we, of course, have clients. And so I'm thinking about how those lessons about boundary setting can apply. Let's maybe talk first about the young lawyers in our office when they've got senior partner beating on the door at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon about that project that suddenly has become an emergency. Do you have suggestions on how those folks might deal with situations like that?
Yeah, well, so you're hitting it on the head in terms of one of the most challenging situations that lawyers can find themselves in when it comes to boundary setting, because people want the answer to be different than this. Sometimes you can effectively set boundaries in these situations. Sometimes part of boundary setting actually is deciding what you're available for and whether or not this environment, these people that you're working for, this firm with its policies, is actually a place for you. And the reason I'm saying it that way is because it absolutely can come to that. I think we all really know that instinctively. But sometimes I find some of the lawyers that I end up talking to, they want to be, oh, but what if? But surely there's a way I can make this situation work. There may be. But what I'm going to suggest to you is that when it really comes down to setting effective boundaries, part of what you're looking at is what is important for you to thrive, what is important for you to enjoy your work, to be productive, to not be stressed out all the time. And before you decide how you're going to address setting the boundary, I think it's actually kind of important to decide, how important is this to you? Is this a deal breaker? Does this really come down to one of the things that I'm not available to be treated in certain ways? I'm not available to do certain kinds of work. I'm not available. Maybe you are, maybe you aren't, right? But I actually, the process that I teach for setting boundaries, think that's something you should be looking at and thinking about. You don't have to make this a hard and fast decision necessarily on the front end, but at least giving some thought to how important, how critical is this boundary for me? And the reason is because when you decide how you're going to go forward and actually start communicating that boundary, what you're going to say about it, and so forth, if you find that the people that you are dealing with are not receptive and that you try, you give that effort, I mean, in a firm, hopefully you've got, besides just the person that you're talking to, that you're dealing with, yes, you can try setting a boundary with that person. You and I both know some people are receptive, some people are not. And if that person happens to be your boss or somebody with a lot of influence in the firm and you're not, then it may be a challenge that is not navigable. Now, I'm not saying give up at that point, but I am saying just be aware that you have to be clear on how important this is to you. And in a firm, I would suggest if you try setting the boundary with the individual, or you might think about it in advance and go, that's actually not the best way because of the individual, because of the circumstance. Maybe there's somebody who is a better choice for you to go talk to first, right? I mean, like with an associate, this partner might not actually be the person who's really has the authority over the associate that would be the best person to have. Or it may be that in a larger firm, you've got somebody in HR that you can go talk to and ask for advice. That's part of the thing that, like, it's impossible to give people in a general context like this the right advice on how to handle this. So if I'm talking to an individual and we're talking about the specifics and the circumstances, then I may or may not be able to make suggestions about, have you thought about this? You might want to approach that. And let's be clear, it would always be the person in the situation who is best suited for deciding what the right approach is, right? Like as a coach, as a mentor, I make suggestions. I oftentimes am asking questions more than I'm giving advice, right? Helping them find the right answers, helping guide them toward, because they usually have a lot more knowledge and understanding of the individuals, of the circumstances. And even if they're not necessarily thinking about the right things yet, right? If I try to come in with my own background and my own experience and tell them what to do rather than helping guide them toward the answer, then there's a danger that I'm projecting my own stuff onto them.
Well, they also have to take ownership of the solution. I mean, it's one thing to give this list of things you recommend, like you were talking about early on when we began this conversation about your clients and your practice. But in the end, I wouldn't think that the best coaching clients would be the ones that just said, tell me what to do. They would have to be bought in to the whole idea. It really is an idea of mindset mastery starts probably with mindset shift. I would think, and look, these are the things that can make your life better. Boundary setting is one of them, but you have to be the one to decide, okay, what do you want your boundary to be and how are you going to enforce it?
Oh, absolutely. When we did in our Calvert Inn experience, my team this year, you probably recall that we did a presentation on boundary setting. And I was really excited to do that in that context because my whole team of lawyers of various different practice levels and also practice areas. We had people who were in law firms, we had people who were judges and judges at different levels speaking to this issue. And one of the things that I found really interesting and rewarding was learning from other lawyers, what are the specific challenges that they're having, right? And how are they resolving them? How are they going about this? And what I found is that, I mean, like Judge Thomas and I were both the sort of criminal law voice on this topic for our team. And he and I, we talked about a specific experience he had had when he was a prosecutor in the county attorney's office with a very challenging individual. And his experience with that individual was such that I think most people probably would have had a real hard time with the way that person was behaving toward him at the time. But he didn't. The way that it impacted him was very different than it would impact a lot of other people, I think. And that's important because it affects whether or not he needs to set a boundary. And if so, how and what that boundary looks like, right? So the same behavior that might be problematic for one person may not be problematic for another. The way that somebody speaks to you, whether or not they're asking you to stay after your normal departure time, all kinds of things that it really has to come down to how that impacts you and what your experience is around it.
Well, the other relationship I can think of, I think I mentioned this just a few minutes ago, aside from boundary setting for, say, newer lawyers with senior lawyers in the office, every lawyer in a practice, in a firm, has some issue probably with boundary setting with clients. I can obviously, and Jody could too, speak from experience on this issue with clients texting you on a Saturday and wanting a response, or a Sunday, or in the evening. And I've spent some time studying this issue myself. My two cents on it, just to throw out there, and we can talk about it a little bit more, is if you make the boundaries clear, clients will generally respect them, but it's important to make them clear because if you engage them in a text exchange on a Saturday, then that moves the boundary marker, at least implicitly, right? And there's lots of other things that clients can do to push boundaries. But in the end, and just offer your two cents on anything specific to client relationships, the same general principles apply to almost any relationship when you're working inside the legal system.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think clients can be one of the most challenging areas for setting boundaries for most lawyers. But it's also a relationship that lends itself, I think, the most to setting boundaries. And here's why. When clients come in, they expect to get new information. They expect to get sort of an orientation almost. I didn't necessarily find this to be an easy area at first, but when I started tackling it, I realized that, like, one of the questions I recommend asking when you sit down to set boundaries is, who's the target audience really? And we're having this conversation and we're saying, well, it's the clients. You have to set boundaries with the clients. And it's like, well, yes, kinda. But it's really a trick question, because what I found is once I identified what my needs were and then what I needed to do, the boundary I needed to set in order to address those needs, that I was actually the biggest culprit, not the client. Right?
You're making exceptions to the boundary?
Exactly. Like you said, are you actually making the exceptions and calling the client or returning their phone call in the evening or on the weekend and then resenting it? Right? I was the one that had to buy into and really believe in my rights and duty to myself and my family to protect my time, to take care of myself. I mean, this is self-care and whatnot. And that when I did, when I bought into it, the clients were usually not so challenging. Actually, there's two tools I would highly recommend. You already alluded to one of them. You alluded to, well, you said calling clients and doing messages outside of business hours. Yes. And that's why I think you should use the scheduling feature for emails and text messages, right? So if you're working outside of your normal work times, even though it's no skin off your nose, even though you've chosen to make an exception right now, if there's not an urgent need for this message to go out this evening on a Saturday, then schedule it for Monday morning.
The irony is I just did that. We're recording this on a Monday, and I just used that feature over the weekend to do that very thing. And I haven't really thought about the text messaging part, but that's something I need to look into also.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. When you are respecting that boundary of not communicating with clients outside of business hours, unless there's a real need to, and then I apologize. This is an exception to my general rule. My general rule is stop apologizing, right? For most of the things, stop apologizing. But for this, when I call them outside of business hours, even though I realize they are probably not bothered by that, because it is an exception to my general rule with regarding work time, I will apologize. I am so sorry for bothering on the weekend, but I knew how important it is for you to have this information before Monday morning. And I decided to check whatever it is, you know, you fill in the blank there on, because you're sending the message that this is an exception. It's an important exception. That's one. And then the other one is written guidelines. So that was one of the most powerful things that I learned to do. And this was actually before the mindset work, and something I do have to give credit for the business coaching that I did. One of the things I learned to do was create a set of written guidelines for new clients that help orientate them to how to communicate with your team, what defines an emergency when they call, and when they do have an emergency that fits that definition, how they should engage that. What the process is, what they should say, what they should do, should they text or should they call? And that's going to be very team specific. And that's not the only area. I mean, written guidelines for new clients are fantastic. And I think it was like, AKA, how to be an A client or something like that, right? And I found that this was really, the people who were my best clients loved getting this and they wanted to know, right?
Well, especially the ones who are rule followers, and you're setting the rules. And so, you know, here are the lanes. Let's not go outside the lane either way. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, and the ones who were not as much, I found that having that document to go back to, and I didn't just like email this to them, right? So they would get it probably in two or three different contexts. I'm thinking of, I'm trying to remember when we first gave it to them, because I think I would send that to them as an attachment after they signed their fee agreement and made their initial payment so that they've actually officially retained the firm. So the welcome message included the new client guidelines. When we had our first sit down face-to-face consult, which I guess some firms are probably doing via Zoom these days, back then it was face-to-face, I would actually have certain portions of that document that I would have tabbed and highlighted to pull out and talk to them about, like the definition of an emergency.
I'm sure you could even go farther, and it depends on the timing of when you share that with them, I guess, but you could even build that into your engagement agreement and say, this is how to work with us. This is how to work with me. And then you can always point back to the engagement agreement and say, this is part of our engagement.
Not only could you, but I think probably should at least allude to it in some context, because you have to decide, I think, on the front end, when a client should be fired and what takes them to that point, right? There's points along the relationship where maybe you can rehabilitate them. You know, they've engaged in some conduct that's not okay with you in terms of how they're treating you or your team or not paying their bill or whatever it is. But I think it's really important to give some thought to that. Like, what behavior constitutes getting basically red rubber banded, right?
Love it. Yeah.
And what happens? And then when is it a done deal? You're fired. You're gone. You're out of here. And if there's money in the IOLTA account, that goes back to you. And we're fine with that, right? And communication is an important one.
Oh, for sure. Well, as we're kind of going beyond the time that we had allocated for today, there's one other area that I wanted to ask you about in terms of boundary setting. And it has to do with working specifically with clients. And that is clients who want you to take indefensible legal positions, whether it be in briefs or in court. Clearly, your ethical obligations prevent you from doing that. But I assume basically the same principles can be applied to that. You can have, as one of the conditions of working with us or working with me, that you're the client and you make final decisions, but I'm not going to take a legal position that I don't think is defensible or that I don't think is in your best interest. I mean, you could massage the language, but have you seen that issue in coaching your clients specifically?
Not as much. It definitely is something that has come up, but when I think of the examples where it's come up, it's more often when I think about legal. In other words, my work as a lawyer, you know, in conversations that I had to sometimes have with clients. And I would actually modify the statement that you made. I don't think they are the final word on everything, right? There are some areas, and I think it's helpful to clarify for them, these are the areas where you get to decide and they're absolute, right? But there are some areas that as the lawyer, it is my job to decide, and how I communicate with opposing counsel is one of them. How, when, et cetera, whether or not I am honest with the court, right? Candor to the tribunal. There are things definitely in criminal law that would come up sometimes where, you know, clients want you to engage in conduct that's not even necessarily something that is an absolute, like candor to the tribunal is very clear, you know, what our duty is there in a lot of situations, right? But I actually also took it to the point of like just being professional, being cordial, being civil. If there's not a strong reason, for example, to oppose a motion for continuance because somebody's having a hard time, family or whatever, then no, client, you do not actually get to dictate how I conduct myself with other lawyers.
In our practice, the lawyers who know what they're doing follow the standards of appellate conduct in addition to the Texas Lawyers Creed. And part of that is you will not oppose a reasonable request for an extension or a continuance. And that is one area in which a lot of us in our practice area would just say, I don't even need to talk to you about this. When it comes to a briefing extension deadline, I mean, 30 days is a quick turnaround, especially if you're new to the case, to try to get a brief done after the record is complete. And that's one area where, for me, it's just absolute. Don't give me a hard time about agreeing to an extension, because that is within my purview. And it's actually an ethical obligation that I have to not only the legal system generally, but to opposing counsel in the courts, is to not oppose a reasonable extension request. And so I would put that on the list. And by all means, I did not mean to imply, by the way, that the client always has the last word on everything. That this is what I just went through is a really good example of that. They do not.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And yeah, that's an area. I'm trying to think back to my fee agreements. I don't think I had something specific to that in the fee agreements, but I definitely had some conversations, you know, with clients where basically I'm saying, that's not something you get to decide. And if that's important to you, then, you know, there are other lawyers.
That's exactly right. Maybe a sort of a last point to cover here is that the kinds of things you're talking about in terms of boundary setting, are there ways that you can best ensure that you have a long and productive career as a lawyer? Because we've seen, all you have to do is pull up, you can Google, pull up statistics on lawyer mental health, and you don't have to look very hard to find instances in which lawyers have basically self-destructed or had issues with substance abuse and other bad self-destructive behaviors. And honestly, I think in part it's because we aren't good at setting boundaries with clients, with, as you point out, courts. It means if we're not good at doing that, that we take on additional stress that we shouldn't have to take on. And this is a great method for helping to manage stress that in a profession that's already stressful enough without difficult clients, judges, difficult legal issues. Presumably you're getting paid and getting paid well to solve a client's legal problems, but you need to be able to say when enough is enough at some point.
I agree. That makes me think of a client who recently shared with me, it hadn't even occurred to me until we had this conversation that there are also medical benefits. But basically, she has a condition that when basically stressful situations, and it started with a situation at work where she needed to basically set boundaries with somebody who was employing her. And so this kind of goes to the associate question that you had. And in her situation, she had two different partners that she was doing work for. And one of them was really kind of her primary supervisor, and the other one was one who she was just kind of doing some additional work for, and had a tendency to engage with her in ways that were very stressful. And the problem is that when she had the stressors going on that were ramped up, it was actually causing her some medical problems. She has an actual serious diagnosed medical condition. And so when we first started working together, one of the things that she had a lot of questions about and that we talked a lot about is setting boundaries. And so I helped her with that. And of course, it's important to me not just to help people by giving them advice about this situation, but teaching them the process that they can use going forward to have autonomy and independence in handling these situations better for themselves going forward in the future. And what was really, really cool and validating that I was just like, I mean, I remember getting goosebumps when she told me about it, is she attributes those boundary setting, that work that she did, that we did, and that she did as a result to, she ended up having a major uptick in her health, her actual test results, like white blood cell count, that kind of thing, because that she had reduced that stress by setting the boundaries, by setting healthy boundaries. And in some cases, she had to make a tough choice. Thankfully, the one partner was supportive, but it actually meant making a change in how she was working with that firm, right? So she went from being on regular payroll to being a contract attorney. And that was appropriate and helpful for her. And actually, in her case, she ended up turning that into her own little business, which is great. I mean, she's thriving now. She's got, you know, multiple employers, so not overly dependent on one and Jane contract. That's not the right solution for everybody, but for her, with the way that, you know, you engage the creative process and the way that you make these kinds of decisions and point yourself down the right paths, that's what led to the right answer for her.
So as we're reaching the end of our time here, our tradition is to kind of wrap up with a tip or a war story. And I know we talked about a few ideas before we started recording. I just wonder if you have something you'd like to offer in addition to all the great stuff you've already given.
I do. This is a really simple one that I think I was kind of surprised when I started using it, how effective it is. I call it the one good thing. Okay. And that's when you have somebody who's challenging, somebody who is difficult to work with. And I'm actually thinking, so this is like opposing counsel would be the equivalent in a civil law, but I'm thinking of a particular prosecutor where this person is just kind of an ass, honestly, and tough to take, tough to deal with. But I think it was the coach I was working with at the time, wherever it is I picked up the tip. The idea is this: if you can find with a challenging person that you're dealing with just one thing that you can genuinely appreciate about that person, okay, stop for a moment and let me assure you, no matter how challenging you find this individual, I promise you, if you put your mind to it, you can find at least one thing. It can be something superficial. In my case, it was that I had reason to know that he was a good father, right? But it might be that this person, maybe he's funny on some particular point. I don't know. I'm sure that a person as smart as all of your audience members are bound to be can find something, right? So just do that, take my word for it, and find the one good thing. Once you do that, it can actually diffuse when you find yourself getting frustrated and triggered by the person. You know, you step back and you think about that one good thing. If you haven't thought of the one good thing yet, try doing it right there in your mind rather than thinking about, you know, the next point that you want to make, right, in the argument they're having with the person. But if you focus on that one thing that you appreciate about the person instead of the things that you don't, it can actually transform that relationship, especially if this is someone you deal with over time. And that's it.
That is great. I really appreciate that. And that's one of those things that's so hard in the law because you are always adversarial to somebody.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.